Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, then take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
For a long time, if you asked Paul Westerberg about a Replacements reunion, he would have cracked you over the head with his guitar. But now, the band is back. I'm Greg Kot from the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. We revisit our classic album dissection of Let It Be by the Replacements, and Greg drops a coin in the Desert Island Jukebox. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
That's the Canadian trio Metz with their song Get Off. And Metz is one of the bands on the shortlist to win its country's Polaris Music Prize. Other nominees include Metric, Colin Stetson, Young Galaxy, and six other Canadian artists. And we're going to find out the winner on September 23rd. At the time of this recording, we don't know who the winner will be, but a lucky few of you listening in different markets and on podcasts will already be the wiser. But with Canada having quite a decade in terms of its contribution to music, we wanted to talk to Polaris founder and executive director Steve Jordan about what's in the water up there. Steve joins us now from the CBC in Toronto. Steve, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
So give us the backstory for the Polaris Music Prize. How did this come into being?
Well, about 10, 11 years ago, I had this eureka moment when, after years of following the Mercury Prize in the UK, I would know five of the acts on their short list, and the other five, because they were on the same list, I checked them out, and I discovered a lot of great music that way. At the time, I was doing A&R for Warner Music in Canada, and as it turns out, a lot of the bands that I was trying to champion went on to some success worldwide, like Metric, Broken Social Scene, Feist, and oddly enough, ended up getting nominated for Polaris a few times, and at least in one case, winning. And, you know, we'll see what happens as Metric is on the shortlist this time. So we were inspired by the Mercury Prize and also the Giller Prize, which is an award for fiction in Canada. And we just thought maybe there is some sort of predisposition in Canada to create another music award that doesn't count sales and purely counts critical opinion.
Well, for listeners who don't remember, the Mercury Prize is the British music industry's honoring of the best recordings of a given year. Greg and I talk about it each year when that list comes out. We've talked about the Polaris Prize, and we talk about the Grammys.
And, you know, Steve, I mean, despite the stated mission of the Recording Academy to honor artistic excellence, it always looks to us as if they're honoring sales achievements and or making good to an artist who really should have gotten some prize 20 years ago, but now they're going to give it now.
Right.
We endlessly pick on the Grammys. Tell us the difference.
Well, the Grammys are voted on by, I believe it's a membership, but you have to have a recording credit to your resume. So I know that there's been a lot of A&R people or label people who have gotten, let's just say, creative credits on albums so that they could qualify to vote for the Grammys. The difference between us, and actually the difference between us and the Mercury Prize as well, is there's no submission process. In other words, there's no fee that you spend and submit your recording to the Polaris jury. And the Polaris jury itself is different. It is entirely made up of music journalists, bloggers, broadcasters, anyone in media who covers music either for a living or a serious hobby in Canada. And we have over 200 people. And they themselves select records and then present them to the rest of the jury for their consideration. So you can be considered for Polaris and not even know you're being considered for Polaris. And in fact, once you make our long list of 40, which we release in June, for a few artists, that's the first they've heard of being selected for it.
Wow. So who's on this jury? So you're saying 200 music critics nominate whatever their favorite album might be to a jury. Who is on the jury that makes the final list?
Don't make me name all 200. I don't want to use up my whole slot.
No, no. But, do you mean the whole 200, or is there an executive panel?
The executive panel, we call them the grand jury.
Yeah.
We select 11 people from that larger jury, and they're the ones that pick the winner from the short list. But the larger jury picks our long list of 40 and our short list of 10. We have an ongoing year-round private discussion online wherein anyone on the jury, it can be a small college radio station, it can be somebody writing for music for the biggest daily paper in Canada, they can bring forth a title for suggestion to the rest of the jury. Once they do that, we'll go to the rights holder for that particular record and we'll get permission to upload it to a server, and then it's available to everyone on the panel.
Steve, we should talk about the diversity on this year's list. You have this art punk band, Godspeed You Black Emperor. And then you have a very successful duo, Tegan and Sarah.
All I want to get is a little bit closer. All I want to know is, can you come a little closer?
But I just want to go back to this notion of letting 200 people vote, you know, from the big daily music critics to the blogger. You know, you crazy Canadians, your socialized medicine, your gun laws, and the idea of letting people who actually like and love music vote on a music prize.
We looked at the jazz and pop. Do you guys both vote in the jazz and pop?
Yep.
Yes, the Village Voice, Pez and Jop poll of there's some 500 critics at this point in America that vote.
Right, so that had a little bit of influence on how we did it as well. I think the other thing is, again, going back to my past career as a frustrated record executive, when I did A&R, you know, I had a lot of different sources, as every A&R person does. Some people are radio people, artist managers, agents, but I found that for musical quality, the best opinions that I got, the best tips that I got were from music writers, because they would be on things before anyone else.
Can I just take a moment to savor that, Steve? I think Greg and I have had a combined 65, 70 years as music journalists, starting as DIY fanzine guys. I've never had any A&R person ever say that to me. Have you, Greg?
No, not lately.
Okay, gloating over.
Right.
But you know, your background as someone from the industry, what do prizes mean today? Now that the major label system is collapsing, people talk about gatekeepers. There are fewer gatekeepers than ever, but that means this avalanche of new music coming at you all the time. So how do you find the stuff that's going to be great?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of our stated objectives. That's one of the models. It's like we're one of many filters that are out there, but our filter is a little bit finer because our filter is made up of 200 different filters. In terms of the benefit that it has, it's what you'd expect, I think, for some artists. It can raise them a degree in their career trajectory, sales, you know. But for other artists, they don't really need that attention from us. I mean, we've had Drake nominated. We've had, you know, Feist nominated, win Arcade Fire. They're beyond any need for the promotion that we provide. But what's great about their embracing of our process is they get to, you know, the high tide floats all boat argument is, if other bands are on the same shortlist as Arcade Fire, yet they haven't sold more than 5,000 copies, some people are going to take that seriously and pay attention to it, especially music lovers, which is our prime audience.
You've got an eclectic list for 2013. What about the range of nominees? This seems to be fairly typical. And when you talk about a range that goes from, say, a hip-hop group like A Tribe Called Red... to an electronic pop group like Purity Ring. Is it your intention to sort of diversify the nominees? Is there some kind of methodology behind the nominees so that they're all not from the same category musically, or is that just sort of happened by luck of the draw?
It's really luck of the draw. And for every person that says, what a diverse list, there's also someone else who complains that the list excludes X, Y, and Z. So, you know, people are constantly on us, and we like to think they are because they care, to broaden the scope of what we do. So we're challenged with that every year.
I'm wondering if any of the nominees this year surprised you. I know you're supposed to say they're all my favorites, but was there anything out there that just sort of jumped out at you as kind of being a little, you know, out of left field for you?
In terms of, well, you know, nothing surprises me because I count the ballots, obviously, but it's more about what the momentum I start to see from the internal discussions that happen amongst our jury. And we haven't mentioned one of our shortlisters, which is Zaki Ibrahim, who, if things go her way in terms of the impact she could have, she could be another Abel Tesfaye. She could be another Weekend type.
We've been talking to Steve Jordan, the founder of the Polaris Prize in Canada. Steve, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot here with Jim DeRogatis, and that is a track from The Replacements at Riot Fest this year. First shows in 22 years for The Replacements, the Minneapolis band that was one of the great bands of the 80s. I think we can all agree on that. Great songs and chaotic live performances, legendary in a lot of circles, finally playing their first set of shows in two decades. The reason for their reunion was that the guitarist in the latter years of the band in its 80s and early 90s incarnation, Slim Dunlop, suffered a stroke last year. And that prompted co-founding members Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson to get together in the studio, start recording some new tracks. Yeah. They put out an EP to defray Slim Dunlop's medical costs. They took that a step further this year. They've been getting offers from festivals, Jim, for years, as you know, to reunite, make a series of comeback shows. They refused all of them. But this year, they thought, hey, maybe it's a good idea. We kind of enjoyed making these songs together. Let's take it a step further. Let's do a couple of appearances. So they agreed to do three shows, one at Riot Fest in Toronto in August, in Chicago a few nights ago, which you and I just saw, Jim, and then wrapping up in Denver. We're going to tie that in with a classic album dissection, the Replacements' 1984 release, Let It Be. That's basically the album that I think, for a lot of people, created the mythology of the Replacements. Yeah. They were a pretty good punk rock band up until that point,
but that
one took them to another level.
Mm-hmm.
But first, before we dive into that album, let's talk about what you and I saw the other night at Riot Fest in Chicago.
Well, usually we don't read each other's reviews before we tape one of these, but I read your review as soon as it came out, and I had written mine. You liked that show. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
I did. I went in very skeptical. You and I talked about this. I wasn't even sure I wanted to go because I didn't want to ruin anything about what I loved about this band.
Because there's so many of these nostalgic oldies cash in.
Sure.
You know, and here you have Bob Stinson, the original guitar player, is dead. And Slim Dunlap had a stroke and can't perform. There's only two guys on stage who were in the Replacements, Westerberg and Tommy Stinson. And Tommy's been sitting around for 20 years waiting for Axl Rose to call him to go tour with Guns N' Roses.
Well, he had been in Guns N' Roses for a while. They both had various solo careers in, you know, various states of
lack of success.
Yeah. Yes, the success maybe wasn't there. Maybe they had run into some just inertia. You sort of sensed, like, what's going to happen with these guys? Are they just going to retire?
Yeah.
But I think Slim Dunlop's medical issues really did galvanize them in a way that they hadn't felt for a number of years. And they realized, hey, we enjoy playing together. The one thing about reunions, about comebacks, the nostalgia element, you know, you and I are both on record as saying, you know, nostalgia is not really where the heart of rock and roll.
It is the enemy of all great art.
But there is a cynical cash-in aspect to nostalgia, and then there's the nostalgia where it's just fun. Let's do a few shows. And I'm willing to give these guys a victory lap. It's been 22 years. They had a bunch of great songs. They broke up somewhat ignominiously, if infamously,
live
on stage
in Chicago.
In Grant Park, where they handed their instruments to their roadies, walked off, never to be seen again.
Yeah.
You know, they deserve a few shows, and I think they approach it with the right attitude. They were having fun. Everybody was expecting, is it going to be a train wreck? Briskly played those 25 songs in 75 minutes. I don't expect them to be the Replacements of 1987 or 1984 or even 1981, but to hear those songs and to hear the original guys, at least two of the key members of the band, the two guys that could actually get up on that stage and do them again, having fun with them, the spirit was there. I love the songs, and I thought if they do these three shows and that's it, that's fine. If they come back again and now you start to see the cash in, that's when it's time to get cynical about it.
But look, I had a higher standard for this band. This band changed my life. It really helped explain to me what punk rock was. No two Replacement sets were ever alike. One out of three of them was magical, and two were disasters. And I don't want to go back. I'm not glorifying the disasters where they were drunk. Nobody liked those shows. You didn't hope for a bad night, but it was all about being spontaneous and here and now in the moment. And 20 of the songs they played in Chicago, or 22 of the songs, were the same exact songs they had played a few weeks earlier in Toronto, and I'm sure they're going to be the same exact songs they play in Denver. And that was not what the band was about. You know, plus, you said not everybody was available. Chris Morris was available. They didn't even bother to call him. Tommy Stinson told Rolling Stone, we knew what the answer would be. He'd say no. So there was something missing there, and it was the spontaneity and the power of the moment. You know, there was nothing but autopilot, you know, nostalgic cover band.
I didn't hear autopilot. I saw a lot of smiles and a band enjoying that moment. And maybe it's going to be on autopilot next year. I don't know. But for that moment, I thought they were in that moment and the audience was in that moment with them. And I love the way they came across as musical fans, paying tribute to the music that influenced them. I mean, whether it was singing Alex Chilton or covering Chuck Berry or Hank Williams, I mean, they were paying tribute to the music that inspired them to pick up a guitar in the first place. And I thought that was the beautiful part about that night.
You liked it, Greg. I wasn't so hot on it. What is a successful reunion show? Let's throw this out to the listeners. What reunions have worked and which ones haven't? Give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800, and we'll air your comments. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, we get into the album Let It Be with Minneapolis music writer Jim Walsh. And later, Greg's a man alone on a desert island.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot here with Jim DeRogatis, and we've been talking about The Replacements and the band's classic album, Let It Be.
Greg, this record still holds up incredibly well, especially considering it'll turn 30 next year. Released in 1984 by Twin Tone Records in Minneapolis, this was The Replacements' third release. You know, sometimes when we do these dissections, we talk about records that are both commercial and critical hits, like Purple Rain by fellow Minneapolitan Prince. Or maybe one that didn't sell a lot, but it's been revered by those in the know, like Big Star. This record didn't make any money, and a lot of critics didn't recognize how it was brilliant at the time. But it was a revolutionary record. It's one of the great lost classics of rock and roll, period, but especially the 80s,
a period when people like Paul Westerberg, the leader of the Placements, the singer and songwriter, Bob Stinson, the scary, large, sort of violent, often drunk guitarist, the idiot savant, if you will, his younger brother, barely 15 or 16 when the band started, Tommy Stinson on bass, Chris Morris, the silent drummer, these four guys were rewriting the rule book.
This was the great shining moment of this band. They made other albums since then that had been more widely celebrated, but they really got put on the map with Let It Be. It was their fourth record. They'd made basically three records in Minneapolis that were fairly obscure. They were known to sort of a certain community of fanzine editors and indie music fans, but you could count those people on two hands in some cities in the United States. Let It Be came out, and suddenly there was this sense around the country that important and great things were happening in Minneapolis, and it wasn't just because of Prince.
And now, of course, as we said before the break, original members Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson have reunited for some live shows after a two-decade break. We wanted to revisit our 2007 discussion with music writer Jim Walsh, who wrote an oral history of the band called The Replacements, All Over But the Shouting, and has a new photographic history called Waxed Up Hair and Painted Shoes. We spoke with Jim at The Current in Minnesota.
You were playing in bands alongside The Replacements. I believe you were at their first gig
Minneapolis.
You were kind of with them every step of the way. You were an eyewitness to history, Jim.
it's sort of amazing. My editor said to me when we kind of finally got the galleys and were going over the last thing, we were sitting there and he goes, "You were sort of doomed to write this book." And it's true, because Paul and Chris and I went to Catholic grade school and high school in Minneapolis, and there's a very similar sort of water that you all drank from that. And then, yeah, we were all in bands.
Well, that's a good place to start. We want to dig deep, Jim, when we do these album dissections, into how the album was made and how it strikes us, what endures about it. But before we get to Let It Be and where the Replacements were when they made this record, bring us up to speed on who they were at that point. I mean, I remember the first time I saw the Replacements. I told you this story for the book. Mm-hmm. They came out. They were a maximum rock and roll underground punk hype.
I saw them in Hoboken, New Jersey at Maxwell's. They came. They were awful. They were horrible. There were all these Mohawks there, expected a punk band because they'd been written up in Maximum Rock and Roll. And they got this guy singing kind of Rolling Stone songs badly. And then the Replacements ended their set, but Paul wasn't done. So he invited the Mohawks, who had been taunting him and throwing beer at him all night, on stage. Paul went behind the drums and played Louie Louie for half an hour with these guys who couldn't play, who picked up the rest of the guy's instruments. You know, Bob was already getting drunker at the bar by that point. And I said, that's when I said, wow, now the whole set was lousy, but there's something special here. And I just went to see them because you went to see anybody on a Saturday night.
Right. And they were, you know, around that time they were doing these, they called them poop sets, and they would be jazz sets. They would play jazz. And it was fascinating. You know, what is this? They were decidedly not trendy. And if that was their reaction at that show, you know, they were an alternative to alternative to alternative to an alternative to punk.
So when they were getting a hipster buzz, they would react against it.
A hipster hardcore buzz. And certainly as Hootenanny was a reaction to Stink and anybody, you know, thinking they were a hardcore band. It was
so Hootenanny is their second album.
Hootenanny was their third record. I mean, it was Sorry Ma was their first record, first full-length album. Then Stink was the EP. And then Hootenanny came after that.
Right.
Setting the context leading up to Let It Be, which was their fourth record, roughly 1980, 1983, 84, that period of time, you had the hardcore punk scene, the Black Flag, the Mohawks, hardcore skinheads. That was the big scene in the underground. You had New Wave kind of morphing over into the synth pop. You had Flock of Seagulls on the on the radio and Culture Club. And then you had these big mega mainstream bands. You know, it was the era of the blockbuster album, the Michael Jacksons, the Princes, the Bruce Springsteens. And then the Replacements really didn't fit with any of that stuff. Even, you know, their contemporaries in the Minnesota scene, Husker Du, you know, their first record, Landspeed record, you know, hardcore punk record. It was kind of understandable where they were coming from, whereas the Replacements, it seemed like,
right,
as you were saying, not really fitting in with any of these things.
But Husker Du was also stretching their whole thing with Zen Arcade that year. So they were paying attention, too. Husker Du did not want to be pigeonholed either.
Right. But they were sort of moving in the same direction as the Replacements were. But that was roughly their third or fourth record where they made that big statement record.
Right.
It was a great year for that underground rock because I remember Let It Be came out that year in 84. Zen Arcade by Husker Du came out that year, and we had also the Minutemen with Double Nickels on the Dime. Really important statements of that whole underground music scene, the independent music scene at that time.
And in Minneapolis, it was Purple Rain, Let It Be, Zen Arcade.
Yeah.
You know, so it was...
Okay, so Jim, you interviewed everybody who was anybody and collected all the archival interviews from the time to tell this oral history in your book. Did the Replacements go into the studio, was it Blackberry Way? Yeah. Did they go into the studio to make a statement record, or was this just the collection of songs that they had that would wind up being phenomenal?
I think that, Hootenanny had been I tell a story in the preface about me kind of bitching at Paul one night and saying, you know, what are you guys doing, you knuckleheads? You know, this great band, and I had seen them for a couple of years, and they just like, they bored me silly. And I swore them off. You're like, I don't need to go see this anymore. It's just,
you were done with the Replacements.
They had not uncorked one of those just transcendent things for, it felt like, a year and a half. So Hootenanny was that, and it was around that time, and they probably were just getting bored with themselves. Also, they had toured with REM, and I think that it probably made them feel like a real band, and like, wow, this is something that is viable. Beyond that, I think it's just as an aesthetic thing, I think they just, you know, Paul's songwriting just ratcheted up.
Why?
You know,
where did that come from? Because as we said, the first three records, they had little gems that said this could be a great band that could write great songs.
Right.
But then there was a lot of noise. And then suddenly, Let It Be is the exact opposite. There are bursts of noise. Tommy gets his tonsils out, right?
Right.
But song after song that is just so deep and moving, and like, where did this come from?
I guess that I would say that probably the REM tour, a lot of people were writing about him, and that affects an artist. You know, Peter Buck's calling you the greatest rock and roll band in America.
Mm-hmm.
You step up a little bit, I think.
But still the sense of humor. I mean, because Greg and I have interviewed Westerberg any number of times, refuses to take himself seriously. I mean, there are a lot of people, Jim, that we've all interviewed that are happy to be the new Dylan and that are being the...
Well, let me tell you how I came up with that lick, Jim.
Yeah, exactly.
It came to me in a...
The source of my brilliance stems from... You know, Westerberg seemed really, even more so than many people, freaked out when people would begin to talk about how deep Unsatisfied was, how deep 16 Blue was.
Drive yourself right up the wall.
And I wonder if Gary's Got a Boner and the cover of Black Diamond by Kiss and Tommy Gets His Tonsils Out are the reaction to that. Because there are two sides of this guy.
No,
there's an absurdist guy.
Yeah, but he was terrified of Bob Stinson, too.
All right, are you not telling?
I mean...
Explain, Jim. Explain.
No, I think that is very much at the crux of why they were great. If you're in a band and you're the guy and all you've got is yes men, yes, 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 yes. Oh, great idea, great.
Yeah.
It's a horrible rock band. So it's like you got Bob Stinson on your left, and Curtis Ace says this very well in the book too. Kurt knew those guys before they were the Replacements. He practiced in this band next to the Stinson's house.
There's a longtime Minneapolis rock scene stalwart.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Kurt is like the Dean of Scream in Minneapolis. But he says that Bob would come to practice and watch those guys and just sneer.
So six foot something, about 250 pounds, right?
Yeah.
A presence who would sometimes, I remember memorable sets, one where he wrapped himself in cellophane to play at CBGB's, another where he was wearing like a baby diaper.
Mm-hmm. And tutus.
It's very P-Funk when you think about it.
It was very P-Funk. I don't know if that's where he got it. And sort of scary. Because he was drunk and tottering and teetering.
But all,
you didn't know when he came up to you whether he was going to slug you or give you a hug.
Right. I think it terrified Paul more than amused him. And it's just, imagine.
So you're saying Paul didn't get feedback from the band. He had to get it from outside.
Bob was like a hardcore critic on his left. And anyone who's ever been in a band knows what that dynamic is. It's very much like you bring a song to the band and they go, what is this? And then you got to come with Gary's Got a Boner or I Hate Music or whatever, because it's, you can hide behind that. When Let It Be started coming together, he was bringing demo stuff to Peter Jespersen, their manager and mentor and friend and
co-producer
label
of the album.
Right. Peter acted as a muse. I'm not saying Paul was writing for Peter, but that was a very sensitive outlet.
Jespersen, it sounded like, was the one voice that Paul could look to when he wanted to write these more sensitive songs that the other guys were just going, get this out of here.
Right.
It's a Brian Epstein kind of thing in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
You know, in later interviews, he would sort of fess up to the idea that he had to sort of summon up his courage to write The Unsatisfieds. Had to placate those guys, and he had to sort of honor that side of the band for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, and remember, Jim, when he went solo, that was one of the reasons he justified it. Now I can write whatever I want. I don't have to please anyone but myself.
Right.
Now I can write these kinds of songs. And, of course, you know, Westerberg's never been as great as he was when he did have those guys.
Well, you look fantastic in your cast of casket. At least the thing still runs. There's 9 to 5 folks. They started to forget. Suicide you're on. I'm the one you trust in. The world knows you nothing. You really, really want it that bad.
so it was a really a beautiful moment in time for this band. The balance was almost perfect.
Maybe right. We're assuming Jim buys something that he doesn't. I mean, because for Greg and I, the reason we're doing the album dissection, we think it's their finest moment. I maintain that I can play for a 17-year-old hardcore fan or a sensitive 17-year-old singer-songwriter, yes. Let It Be, and he or she's going to have their mind blown.
Absolutely.
Because it stands. I think it stands as their best album.
And I think that they, throughout their entire career, they were looking to that. They were not trendy. And I agree. I mean, and that's the thrill of putting this book together is that, you know, this Christmas there's going to be, you know, some cool uncle or aunt or somebody is going to give some 16-year-old kid and go, here, this is why I'm so screwed up.
Gathering from the chronology that you've put together in All Over But the Shouting, I Will Dare seems like this kind of a starting point, the transition from Hootenanny, where you started to hear the songs that this band was capable of. And then I Will Dare, another leap up altogether, a song that everybody seems to agree that if that song had been released in 1992, would have been a top five worldwide single along the lines
of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit. It just had, you know,
never thought of that. Yeah.
You know, the wrong timing. It was 8 years too soon, but it was that good of a song.
The reason we seize on I Will Dare is because it's a pop song.
Yeah.
And it shimmers coming out of any speaker, dashboard, or show you're at.
Not a lot of production on the first three recordings The Replacements released, and suddenly there is. They're doing finger snaps, they're doing maracas, they're doing percussion.
They're doing Peter Buck's mandolin.
Peter Buck's mandolin. Chan Pauling comes in and plays keyboards. Mm-hmm. There's the answering machine on Answering Machine. Were they starting to have fun in the studio? I mean, you get the impression when you listen to The Replacements Stink and Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash, these were records made in like 2 hours, and they wish they could have done it in 30 minutes.
Paul even said he likes producers who work fast, and that's very understandable with rock and roll especially. It's like, you know, you've written the song, you want to get it down as you have written it. You want that spirit encased or something. I think there was a sense, a real respect for the songs. And so I think that they just went, you know, we have to render these as imaginatively as the songs are written.
But I think what you're getting at, Jim Walsh, is the spontaneity in the moment for this band was all it was about. And
right.
It seemed like every stage show was that way, too. It was not thought about ahead of time. It was not thought about afterward. What do we feel like right now? And that's the way it's always seemed to be with that band. That was the charm of it.
That's absolutely right on. And it was not an intellectual experience.
Yeah.
It was this communal thing. And some nights it would just lay there because it just wasn't happening.
Yeah.
But the nights when all the forces came together and coagulated, like I keep saying, funnel cloud or something. It really felt like that. Like, something's happening here, something's happening, and you wrote it, and you knew it was, the clock was ticking. You knew this band was unlike anything else that came before or since, mm-hmm. really.
We want to thank Jim Walsh, our friend and a colleague with The Replacements all over but The Shouting in oral history. Jim, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, you guys. It was a pleasure.
We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX with more of our classic album dissection of The Replacements' Let It Be and a Desert Island Jukebox track from Greg.
To get it all wrong. One more time to do it all wrong. One more night to get it half right. Here comes Dick. He's wearing a skirt. Here comes Jane, you know she's sporting a chain. Same hair, evolution, same build, evolution. Tomorrow who's gonna fuss? And they love each other so, androgynous. Closer than you know, love each other so, androgynous.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and we're wrapping up our classic album dissection of The Replacements' 1984 album, Let It Be. We'd like to play the song that we think epitomizes it, Unsatisfied, without a doubt.
Every time this song plays, it brings a little tear to the eye, a little chill up the spine.
Absolutely.
It's an emotional bloodletting that really was a revelation for The Replacements and Westerberg. I think part of the key to this song, Jim, was that the courage that Westerberg had to muster up to even do it, because The Replacements were a bunch of wisecracking guys who didn't appreciate sentimentality or any kind of emotion that wasn't juvenile in some ways.
Right. They were not an emo band.
And Paul Westerberg, however, was growing up, and the fact that he was able to wear his heart on his sleeve this way really said a lot about him as a songwriter and his growth as a songwriter. He makes this song not only with his lyrics and vocal, but the instrumentation, the 12-string guitar, the lap steel, things you didn't hear on punk records very mm-hmm. much at that time. But it creates this amazing emotional atmosphere with the music he plays.
You know, it's a song about not getting none. You know,
yeah.
The Rolling Stones in the 60s has Satisfaction. I think the indie rock 80s, the post-punk generation had Unsatisfied. Who can't relate to that fact of being 20-something, having no significant relationship in your life, just one-night stands if you're lucky? And on the bigger level, is this all there is in my life?
Right.
You know, earlier in that record, they sing about bacon and cigarettes. What a lousy dinner. That's what those guys were living on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's asking himself, isn't there more? I feel like I have more to say and more to do in life, but I can't get out of this town. With this song and with Let It Be, they would get out of this town. They would be known by some people, at least. I think they created a timeless classic that's up there with Satisfaction, and we just have to play it. It's Unsatisfied by The Replacements.
Thank you.
man, that voice. That's the other thing, Greg. What a vocal performance. Unsatisfied by the Replacements. You know, Let It Be has only sold about 250,000 copies to this day.
It's a crime.
But it doesn't matter. You know, another guy from Minneapolis-St. Paul said, in American lives, there are no second acts. It wouldn't matter. Replacements created a perfect album. It's worth seeking out, and people's lives will be better if they do.
If you want to share your own thoughts on Let It Be, leave us a voicemail at 888-859-1800.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible on Sound Opinions, one of us takes a trip to the desert island and plays you a song on the jukebox that we cannot live without. Mr. Cott, you are getting into the hovercraft and heading out there to the desert island. What do you got for us?
Jim, I've got a desert island jukebox pick inspired actually by your last DIJ. You played the Saints and kind of a soul version of the Saints, that great punk band out of Australia.
And I played them based on your previous DIJ. We're on this kick now.
We are. And it reminded me of the fact that, yes, soul music, R&B, that sort of dance element was lacking in many ways in the late 70s punk movement. It seemed to have been erased from music for a little bit. And there were a couple of bands, a couple of artists who kept it alive. The Saints on the track you played a couple of weeks ago. And I'm also thinking about Graham Parker out of the UK. He was a contemporary of people like Elvis Costello and The Clash and the Sex Pistols. So he was sort of put into that punk movement. He was a songwriter who was working a series of dead-end jobs and a serious soul fanatic. He met this band, The Rumour, a bunch of pub rockers from London who were excellent, versatile musicians looking for sort of a visionary leader, somebody who could write some great songs that they could play on. And Parker was the guy. He had a voice like a howitzer. I mean, it came at you. You could hear the anger and the frustration in it, but also that deep soul that had so influenced him throughout his life and was figuring primarily in his music. You know, he was working things in like horns and Hammond organ that were really considered passé at the time. And what he said was, I'm really looking for an antidote to what I'm hearing as this sort of white music that has taken over everything in the UK, whether it was progressive rock or punk. I want to bring back some of that Stax and Motown stuff that influenced me so much as a kid. The track I'm going to play is called Pouring It All Out, and it's basically Graham Parker's manifesto saying, my reason for being is to get up here and the ability to sort of pour it out like those great soul singers like Levi Stubbs and Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye and Sam and Dave, those guys that influenced me as a youngster growing up in England. It's Pouring It All Out from Graham Parker on Sound Opinions.
Yes, cold and hot, and the rain came tumbling down like a wild December night. No love left. Quite alone in a crowd. Yet I really want some New Year's celebration. Yeah.
Pouring It All Out by Graham Parker and The Rumor, Greg Kot's Desert Island Jukebox pick for the week. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
Next week, Jim, a live performance and interview with the great UK band Savages.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Sound Opinions is produced by Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, and Anthony Martinez. And one last news note on the way out. If you're looking forward to a punk rock Christmas, Bad Religion is dropping a holiday album.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Hi guys, this is Ian from Bolingbrook, Illinois, and I'm calling in reference to your Janelle Monáe review of her new album, The Electric Lady, and I have to say, I completely disagree with a lot of the things you guys said. I have been an avid fan of hers for an extremely long time since her first one came out, and I will agree that it's not as good as the Arc Android as a whole, but I believe by far that the shining moments of the album with Solange and Prince and Miguel far, far, far outshine the lower middle notes. I just hope that the next time she comes out with a new CD, you guys see the light, I guess. Good show. Hope you guys don't take too much offense to what I said. Bye.
Hi there. My name is Mike. I live in Canyon City, Colorado. I've never even heard your show before, but I stumbled across it tonight, and it was really fun to listen to the guys from Cheap Trick carry on. Back when I was a kid in Illinois, I used to sneak into bars and listen to them when I was underage. And they were great then, and they sound like they're still great now. It was really fun to hear that, and I appreciate the show that you gave. Thanks, guys. I'll try to listen again next week. Bye now.
Hey guys, it's Chris over in New York working in the JFK area. I just want to really thank you for putting on Cheap Trick, not because they've been around for so long, but look at four guys with the new drummer now, too, that just sound as good as they did when they came out in the 70s. It's amazing what they can do now in the studios, but the four guys that never sounded so tight, so clean, and just so happy just being together and just doing music. You know, I really want to appreciate and thank you for taking time out and having them on. Okay? All right, take care. Bye.
My name is Gloria Gutsoff from Fairmount Park. You had mentioned live albums, and I just wanted to say I'm not really into Cheap Trick, and I really don't like live albums in general because I don't like to hear songs sounding like very different from the way I'm used to them. But the only live album that matters to me is Rattle and Hum by U2. I know it's, you know, kind of critically panned, but I think every song is excellent, and especially the live version of My Silver Sound I'm Looking For with the Gospel Choir. I just think it is brilliant and a perfect album. I'd be curious to know what you guys think of it. Thank you. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
no more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.
With one of the best savings rates in America, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than choosing Slash to be in your band.
Next up for lead guitar. You're in.
Cool. Yep, even easier than that. And with no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank for details. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.